Ruth had been touched by his generosity, his concern for her security. He knew how much she worried over the future, and the fact that they had not yet changed the deed, well, that was more her fault than his. She was supposed to decide on the percentage interest she should have, then call the lawyer and set up the paperwork. But how could you express love as a percentage? She felt as she had when a college history professor of hers had told the students in the class to grade themselves. Ruth had given herself a B-, and everyone else had taken an A.
You could hire someone to check on your mother a few times a week, Art suggested, like a housekeeper.
That's true.
And call that service, Meals on Wheels. They might be able to deliver food while we're gone.
That's an idea.
In fact, why don't you start now, so she gets used to the food? Not that she isn't welcome to dinner here whenever she wants.
Listen, I really have to get some work done now. Are you going to take her home soon?
I guess. When you get back, we'll have some rum raisin ice cream.
He named her favorite flavor.
It'll make you feel better.
Luling had objected to the idea of having anyone come to her house to help clean. Ruth had anticipated she would. Her mother hated spending money on anything she believed she could do herself, from hair coloring to roof repairs.
It's for an immigrant training program, Ruth lied, so they won't have to go on welfare. And we don't have to pay anything. They're doing it free so they can put work experience on their resume.
Luling readily accepted this reasoning. Ruth felt like a bad child. She would be caught. Or maybe she wouldn't, and that would be worse. Another reminder that the disease had impaired her mother's ability to know and see everything. A few days after the first housekeeper started, Luling called to complain.
She thinks she come to America, everything so easy. She want take brick. Then tell me, lady, I don't move furniture. I don't do window. I don't do iron. I ask her, you think you don't lift finger become millionaire? No, America not this way.
Luling continued to give the immigrant good advice until she quit. Ruth started interviewing new prospects, and until someone was hired, she decided she should go to Luling's a few times a week to make sure the gas burners weren't on and water wasn't flooding the apartment.
I was in the neighborhood to drop off some work for a client, she explained one day.
Ah, always for client. Work first, mother second.
Ruth went to the kitchen, carrying a bag of oranges, toilet paper, and other grocery essentials. While there, she checked for disasters and danger. The last time she'd been there, she found that Luling had tried to fry eggs with the shells still on. Ruth did a quick sweep of the dining room table and picked up more junk mail offers Luling had filled out.
I'll mail these for you, Mom, she said.
She then went to the bathroom to make sure the faucets weren't running.
Where were the towels?
There was no shampoo, only a thin slice of cracked soap. How long it had been since her mother had bathed? She looked in the hamper. Nothing there. Was her mother wearing the same clothes every day? The second housekeeper lasted less than a week. On the days she didn't visit, Ruth felt uneasy, distracted. She was not sleeping well and had broken a molar grinding her teeth at night. She was too tired to cook and ordered pizza several times a week, giving up her resolve to set a low-fat example for Dory, and then having to endure Luling's remarks that the pepperoni was too salty. Recently, Ruth had developed spasms across her shoulders that made it hard to sit at her desk and work at her computer. She didn't have enough fingers and toes to keep track of everything. When she found a Filipina who specialized in elder care, she felt a huge burden removed.
"I love old people," the woman assured her. "They're not difficult if you take time to get to know them."
But now it was night, and Ruth lay awake listening to the foghorns warning ships to stay clear of the shallows. The day before, when she picked up her mother for dinner, Ruth learned that the Filipina had quit.
"Gone,"
Luling said, looking satisfied.
"When?"
"Never work."
"But she was at your house until, what, 2 days ago, 3 days ago?" After more questioning, Ruth deduced that the woman had not been coming since the day after she started. Ruth would never be able to find another person before she left for Hawaii. That was only 2 days from now. A vacation across the ocean was out of the question.
"You go,"
Ruth told Art in the morning. They had already paid for the rental, and there was a no-refund policy.
"If you don't go, what fun would that be? What would I do?" Not work, not get up, not return phone calls. It won't be the same. You'll miss me dreadfully and tell me you were miserable. Eventually, much to Ruth's chagrin, he agreed with her logic. The next morning, Art left for Hawaii. The girls were at Miriam's for the week, and though Ruth was accustomed to working alone during the day, she felt empty and anxious. Soon after she settled in at her desk, Gideon called to say that the internet spirituality author had fired her. Fired, a first in her career. Although she had finished his book earlier than scheduled, he had not liked what she had written.
"I'm as pissed as you are," Gideon said, and Ruth knew she should be outraged, maybe even humiliated, but in fact she was relieved. One less thing to think about.
"I'll try to do damage control with the contract in Harper, San Francisco," Gideon went on, "but I may also need for you to document your time spent and outline why his complaints were not in keeping with reality."
"Hello, Ruth, are you still there?"
"Sorry, I was a little preoccupied."
"Hun, I've been meaning to talk to you about that, not to imply that you're somehow at fault for what happened, but I am concerned that you haven't been your usual self. You seem..."
I know, I'm not going to Hawaii so I can catch up."
"I think that's a good idea. By the way, I think we're going to hear about the other book project today, but frankly, I don't think you'll get it. You should have told them you had an emergency appendectomy or something."
Ruth had failed to show up at an interview because her mother had called in a panic, thinking her alarm clock was the smoke detector going off. At 4, Agape called to discuss final edits for Writing the Wrong Child. An hour later, they were still talking. Agape was eager to start a new book, which she wanted to call either Past Perfect Tension or The Embedded Self. Ruth kept staring at the clock. She was supposed to pick up her mother at 6 for dinner at Fountain Court.
"Habit, neuromusculature, and the limbic system, that's the basis," Agape was saying. "From babyhood and our first sense of insecurity, we clench, grasp, flail. We embed the response, but forget the cause, the past that was imperfect."
"Ruth, my dear, you seem to be somewhere else. Should you ring me later when you feel more refreshed?" At 5:15, Ruth called her mother to remind her she was coming. No answer. She was probably in the bathroom. Ruth waited 5 minutes, then called again. Still no answer. Did she have constipation? Had she fallen asleep? Ruth tidied her desk, put the phone on speaker, and hit automatic redial. After 15 minutes of unanswered ringing, she had run through all the possibilities until they culminated in the inevitable worst possible thing. Flames leaping from a pot left on the stove, Luling dousing the flames with oil, her sleeve catching fire. As Ruth drove to her mother's, she braced herself to see a crackling blaze eating the roof, her mother lying twisted in a blackened heap. Just as she feared, when Ruth arrived, she saw lights flickering in the upper level, shadows dancing. She rushed in. The front door was unlocked.
"Mom? Mommy? Where are you?"
The television was on, blasting Amor Sin Limite at high volume. Luling had never figured out how to use the remote control, even though Ruth had taped over all but the power, channel up and channel down buttons. She turned off the TV, and the sudden silence frightened her. She ran to the back rooms, flung open closets, looked out the windows. Her throat tightened.
"Mommy, where are you?" she whimpered. "Answer me."
She ran down the front steps and knocked on the tenant's door. She tried to sound casual.
"By any chance, have you seen my mother?"
Francine rolled her eyes and nodded knowingly.
"She went charging down the sidewalk about 2 or 3 hours ago. I noticed because she was wearing slippers and pajamas, and I said to myself, 'Wow, she looks really flipped out. Like it's none of my business, but you should take her to the doctor and get her medicated or something. I mean that in a good sense.'"
Ruth raced back upstairs. With shaky fingers, she called a former client who was a captain in the police department. Minutes later, a Latino officer stood at the doorway, and his face was serious. Ruth's panic notched up. She stepped outside.
"She has Alzheimer's," Ruth jabbered. "She's 77, but has the mind of a child."
"Description?"
4'11", 85 pounds, black hair pulled into a bun, probably wearing pink or lilac pajamas and slippers.
Ruth was picturing Luling as she said this, the puzzled look on her mother's face, her inert body lying in the street. Ruth's voice started to wobble. Oh, God, she's so tiny and helpless.
Does she look anything like that lady there?
Ruth looked up to see Lu Ling standing stock still at the end of the walkway. She was wearing a sweater over her pajamas.
Aya, what happened? Lu Ling cried. Robber?
Ruth ran toward her.
Where were you?
She appraised her mother for signs of damage. The officer walked up to the two of them.
Happy ending, he said, then turned toward his patrol car.
Stay there, Ruth ordered her mother. I'll be right back.
She went to the patrol car, and the officer rolled down his window.
I'm sorry for all the trouble, she said. She's never done this before.
And then she considered that maybe she had, but she just didn't know it. Maybe she did this every day, every night. Maybe she roamed the neighborhood in her underwear.
Hey, no problem, the policeman said. My mother-in-law did the same thing, sundowning. The sun went down, she went wandering. We had to put alarm triggers on all the doors. That was one tough year, until we put her in a nursing home. My wife couldn't do it anymore, keeping an eye on her day and night.
Day and night? And Ruth thought she was being diligent by having her mother over for dinner and trying to hire a part-time housekeeper.
Well, thanks anyway, she said.
When she returned to her mother, Lu Ling complained right away.
Grocery store round the corner? I walk round and round, gone. Turn into bank. You don't believe? Go see yourself.
Ruth wound up staying the night at her mother's, sleeping in her old bedroom. The foghorns were louder in this section of the city. She remembered listening to them at night when she was a teenager. She would lie in bed, counting the blasts, matching them to the number of years it would be before she could move out. 5 years, then four, then three. Now she was back. In the morning, Ruth opened the cupboards to look for cereal. She found dirty paper napkins folded and stacked. Hundreds. She opened the fridge. It was packed with plastic bags of black and greenish mush, cartons of half-eaten food, orange peels, cantaloupe rinds, frozen goods long defrosted. In the freezer were a carton of eggs, a pair of shoes, the alarm clock, and what appeared to have been bean sprouts. Ruth felt sick. This had happened in just 1 week? She called Art and Kauai. There was no answer. She pictured him lying serenely on the beach, oblivious to all problems in the world. But how could he be on the beach? It was 6 in the morning there. Where was he? Hula dancing in someone's bed? Another thing to worry about. She could call Wendy, but Wendy would simply commiserate by saying her own mother was doing far crazier things. How about Gideon? He was more concerned about clients and contracts. Ruth decided to call Auntie Gal.
Worse? How can she be worse? Gao Ling said. I gave her ginseng, and she said she was taking this every day.
The doctor said none of those things will help.
Doctor, Gao Ling snorted. I don't believe this diagnosis, Alzheimer's. Your uncle said the same thing, and he's a dentist. Everybody gets old. Everybody forgets. When you're old, there's too much to remember. I ask you, why didn't anyone have this disease 20, 30 years ago? The problem is, today's kids have no time anymore to see parents. Your mommy's lonely, that's all. She has no one to talk to in Chinese. Of course, her mind is a little rusted. If you stop speaking, no oil for the squeaky wheel.
Well, that's why I need your help. Can she come visit you, maybe for the week? It's just that I have a lot of work this week and can't spend as much time.
No need to ask. I'm already offering. I'll come get her in 1 hour. I need to do some shopping there anyway.
Ruth wanted to weep with relief. After Auntie Gal left with her mother, Ruth walked a few blocks to the beach, to Land's End. She needed to hear the pummeling waves, their constancy and loudness, drowning out her own pounding heart. As Ruth walked along the beach, the surf circled her ankles and tugged. Go seaward, it suggested, vast and free. When Ruth was a teenager, her mother had once run off in the middle of an argument, declaring she was going to drown herself in the ocean. She had waded into her thighs before her daughter's screams and pleas had brought her back. And now Ruth wondered, if she had not begged her mother to return, would Lu Ling have let the ocean decide her fate? Since childhood, Ruth had thought about death every day, sometimes many times a day. She thought everyone must secretly do the same, but no one talked openly about it except her mother. She had pondered in her young mind what death entailed. Did people disappear? Become invisible? Why did dead people become stronger? That's what her mother seemed to think. When Ruth was older, she tried to imagine the precise moment when she could no longer breathe or talk or see, when she would have no feelings, not even fear that she was dead. Or perhaps she would have plenty of fear, as well as worry, anger, and regrets, just like the ghosts her mother talked to. Death was not necessarily a portal to the blank bliss of absolute nothingness. It was a deep dive into the unknown, and that contained all sorts of bad possibilities. It was that unknown which made her decide that no matter how terrible and unsolvable her life seemed, she would never willingly kill herself. Although she remembered a time when she had tried. It happened the year she turned 11. Ruth and her mother had moved from Oakland to the flatlands of Berkeley, to a dark shingled bungalow behind a butter-yellow cottage owned by a young couple in their 20s, Lance and Dottie Rogers. The bungalow had been a potting shed and garage that Lance's parents remodeled into an illegal in-law unit during World War II and rented to a series of brides whose husbands had departed for battle in the Pacific via the Alameda Naval Station. The ceilings were low, the electricity often shorted out, and the back wall and one side abutted a fence on which alley cats howled at night. There was no ventilation, not even a fan over the two-burner gas stove, so that when Lulin cooked at night, they had to open the windows to let out what she called the greasy smell. But the rent was cheap, and the place was in a neighborhood with a good intermediate school, attended by the smart and competitive sons and daughters of university professors. That was why Luling had moved there in the first place, she liked to remind Ruth, for her education. With its small paned windows and yellow shutters, the bungalow resembled a dollhouse. But Ruth's initial delight soon turned into peevishness. The new home was so small she had no privacy. She and her mother shared a cramped, sunless bedroom that allowed for nothing more than twin beds and a dresser. The combined living room, eating area, and efficiency kitchen afforded no place to hide. Ruth's only refuge was the bathroom, and perhaps for this reason she developed numerous stomach ailments that year. Her mother was usually in the same room as she was, doing her calligraphy, cooking, or knitting, activities that kept her hands busy, but left her tongue all too free to interrupt Ruth when she was watching TV.
"Your hair getting too long. Hair cover your glasses like curtain can't see. You think this good-looking, I telling you not good-looking. You tune off TV. I cut hair for you. Hey, you hear me? Tune off TV."
Her mother took Ruth's television watching as a sign that she had nothing better to do, and sometimes she would see this as a good opportunity for a talk. She would take down the sand tray from the top of the refrigerator and set it on the kitchen table. Ruth's throat would grow tight. Not this again. But she knew that the more she resisted, the more her mother would want to know why.
"Precious auntie mad at me?" her mother would say when Ruth had sat for several minutes without writing anything in the sand. "It's not that." "You feel something else matter? Another ghost here?"
"It's not another ghost."
Oh, I know. I die soon. All right? You can say I'm not afraid."
The only time her mother didn't bother her was when she was doing her homework or studying for a test. Her mother respected her studies. If she interrupted her, all Ruth had to do was say, "Shh, I'm reading." And almost always, her mother fell quiet. Ruth read a lot. On good weather days, Ruth would take her book to the dwarf-sized porch of the bungalow, and there she'd sit with tucked legs on a bouncy patio chair with a clam-shaped back. Lance and Dottie would be in the yard smoking cigarettes, pulling weeds out of the brick walkway, or pruning the bougainvillea that covered one wall of their cottage like a bright quilt. Ruth would watch them surreptitiously, peering over the top of her book. She had a crush on Lance. She thought he was handsome, like a movie star with his neatly cropped hair, square jaw, and lanky athletic body. And he was so easygoing, so friendly to her, which made her feel even more shy. She had to pretend to be fascinated by her book or the snails that slimed the elephant plants, until finally he noticed her and said, "Hey there, Squirt, you can go blind reading too much." His father owned a couple of liquor stores, and Lance helped with the family business.
He often left for work in the late morning and returned at 3:30 or 4, then took off again at 9 and came back late, long after Ruth had given up listening for the sound of his car. Ruth wondered how Dottie had been lucky enough to marry Lance. She wasn't even that pretty, though Ruth's new friend at school, Wendy, said that Dottie was cute in a beach bunny way. How could she say that? Dottie was tall and bony and about as huggable as a fork. Plus, as her mother had pointed out, Dottie had big teeth. Her mother had demonstrated to Ruth by pulling her own lips back with her fingers so that her gums showed on the top and bottom.
"Big teeth show too much inside out, like monkey."
Later Ruth stared in the bathroom mirror and admired her own small teeth. There was another reason Ruth thought Dottie did not deserve Lance. She was bossy and talked too loud and fast. Sometimes her voice was milky, as if she needed to clear her throat, and when she yelled, it sounded like rusty metal. On warm evenings, when their back windows were open, Ruth listened as Lance's and Dottie's garbled voices drifted across the yard and into the bungalow. On quite a few occasions, when they argued, she could hear clearly what they were saying.
"Damn it, Lance," she heard Dottie yell one night, "I'm going to throw out your dinner if you don't come right now."
"Hey, give me a break. I'm on the can," he answered. After that, whenever Ruth was in the bathroom, she imagined Lance doing the same, the two of them trying to avoid the people who nagged them without end. Another night, as Ruth and her mother sat at the kitchen table with the sand tray between them, Dottie's husky voice rang out.
"I know what you did. Don't you play Mr. Innocent with me."
"Don't tell me what the fuck I did, 'cause you don't know."
This was followed by two door slams and the revving of the red Pontiac before it roared off. Ruth's heart was racing along with it. Her mother shook her head and clucked her tongue, then muttered in Chinese,
"Those foreigners are crazy."
Ruth felt both thrilled and guilty over what she had heard. Dottie had sounded just like her mother, accusing and unreasonable. And Lance suffered as she did. The only difference was he could talk back. He said exactly what Ruth wished she could tell her mother. "Don't tell me what I think, 'cause you don't know." In October, her mother asked her to give the rent check to the Rogers. When Dottie opened the door, Ruth saw that she and Lance were busy unloading a huge box. Inside was a brand new color television set, brought home in time to watch The Wizard of Oz, Dottie explained, which was going to air at 7 o'clock that night. Ruth had never seen a color TV before, except in a store window.
"You know that part in the movie where everything is supposed to go from black and white to color?" Dottie said. "Well, on this set, it really does turn to color."
"Hey, Squirt," Lance said, "why don't you come over and watch with us?"
Ruth blushed.
"I don't know." "Sure, tell your mom to come over too," said Dottie. "I don't know, maybe."
Then Ruth rushed home. Her mother did not think she should go.
"They just polite, don't really mean." "Yes, they do. They asked me twice."
Ruth had left out the part about their inviting Lu Ling as well.
"Last year, report card, you get one satisfactory, not even good. Should be everything excellent. Tonight, better study more."
"But that was in P.E., Ruth wailed.
"Anyway, you already see this Ozzy show. It's The Wizard of Oz, not Ozzy and Harriet, and this one's a movie. It's famous." "Famous. Everybody don't watch, then no longer famous. Ozzy, Oz, Zorro, same thing." "Well, Precious Auntie thinks I should watch it."
"What you mean?" Ruth didn't know why she had said that. The words just popped out of her mouth.
"Last night, remember?"
She searched for an answer.
"She had me write something that looked like a letter Z, and we didn't know what it meant."
Lu Ling frowned, trying to recall.
"I think she wanted me to write O-Z. We can ask her now if you don't believe me."
Ruth went to the refrigerator, climbed the step stool, and brought down the sand tray.
"Precious Auntie," Lu Ling was already calling in Chinese. "Are you there? What are you trying to say?"
Ruth sat down with the chopstick poised for action. For a long time, nothing happened, but that was because she was nervous she was about to trick her mother. What if there really was a ghost named Precious Auntie? Most of the time, she thought the sand writing was just a boring chore, that it was her duty to guess what her mother wanted to hear, then move quickly to end the session. Yet Ruth had also gone through times when she believed that a ghost was guiding her arm, telling her what to say. Sometimes she wrote things that turned out to be true, like tips for the stock market, which her mother started investing in to stretch the money she had saved over the years. Her mother would ask Precious Auntie to choose between two stocks, say IBM and U.S. Steel, and Ruth chose the shorter one to spell. No matter what she picked, Lu Ling profusely thanked Precious Auntie. One time her mother asked where Precious Auntie's body was lying so she could find it and bury it. That question had given Ruth the creeps, and she tried to steer the conversation to a close. "The end," she wrote, and this made her mother jump out of her chair and cry, "It's true, then. Gao Ling was telling the truth. You're at the end of the world." Ruth had felt a cold breath blow down her neck. Now she steadied her hand and mind, conjuring the wisdom Precious Auntie might impart like the wizard. "O-Z," she wrote, and then started to write "good" slowly and in large letters. G-O-O. And before she could finish, Lu Ling exclaimed, "Gu! Gu! Gu means bone in Chinese. What about bone? This concern bone doctor family?" And so by luck, all fell into place. The Wizard of Oz, Precious Auntie was apparently saying, was also about a bone doctor, and she would be happy for Ruth to see this. At 6:58, Ruth knocked on Lance and Dottie's door.
"Who is it?" Lance yelled.
"It's me, Ruth."
"Who?"
And then she heard him mutter, "God damn it." Ruth was humiliated. Maybe he really had asked her only out of politeness. She bolted down the steps of the front porch. Now she'd have to hide in the backyard for 2 hours, so her mother would not know about her mistake or her lie. The door swung open.
"Hey there, Squirt," he said warmly. "Come on in. We almost gave up on you. Hey, Dottie, Ruth's here. While you're in the kitchen, get her a soda, will you? Here, Ruth, sit yourself down here on the sofa."
During the movie, Ruth had a hard time paying attention to the television screen. She had to pretend to be comfortable. The three of them were sitting on a turquoise and yellow sofa that had the woven texture of twine and tinsel. It scratched the backs of Ruth's bare legs. Besides that, Ruth kept noticing things that shocked her, like how Dottie and Lance put their feet up on the coffee table without removing their shoes. If her mother saw that, she'd have more to talk about than Dottie's big teeth. What's more, Lance and Dottie were both drinking a golden-colored booze, and they weren't even in a cocktail lounge. But what most bothered Ruth was the stupid way Dottie was acting, babyish, stroking her husband's left knee and thigh while crooning things like, "Lancey Pants, could you turn up the volume a teensy-weensy smidge?" During a commercial, Dottie untangled herself, stood up, and wobbled about tipsily like the scarecrow in the movie. "How about some pop-pop-pop-popcorn, everybody?" And then with arms swinging widely, she took one step backward and loped out of the room singing, "Oh, we're off to see the kitchen." Now Ruth found herself on the sofa alone with Lance. She stared ahead at the television, her heart thumping. She heard Dottie humming, the sound of cabinets being opened and shut.
"So what do you think?" Lance said, nodding toward the television.
"It's really neat,"
Ruth answered in a small, serious voice, her eyes trained on the screen. She could smell the oil heating in the kitchen, hearing the machine gun spill of popcorn kernels into the pot. Lance swished the ice cubes in his glass and talked about the programs that he hoped were broadcasting in color. Football, Mr. Ed, the Beverly Hillbillies. Ruth felt like she was on a date. She turned slightly toward him.
"Listen with a fascinated expression." Wendy had told her this was what a girl should do to make a boy feel manly and important. But what came after that? Lance was so close to her. All at once, he patted her knee, stood up, and announced,
"I guess I better use the can before the show comes back on."
What he said was embarrassingly intimate. She was still blushing when he came back a minute later. This time he sat down even closer than before. He could have scooted over to where Dottie had been. So why hadn't he? Was it on purpose? The movie resumed. Was Dottie coming back soon? Ruth hoped not. She imagined telling Wendy how nervous she felt.
"I thought I was going to pee in my pants."
That was just an expression. But now that she had thought it, she really did have to pee.
This was terrible. How could she ask Lance if she could use the bathroom? She couldn't just get up and wander the house. Should she be casual like him and just say she had to use the can? She gripped her muscles, trying to hold on. Finally, when Dottie came in with the bowl of popcorn, Ruth blurted, "I have to wash my hands first."
"Through the back, past the bedroom," Dottie said.
Ruth tried to act casual, walking speedily while clenching the tops of her thighs together. As she flew past the bedroom, she smelled stale cigarettes, saw an unmade bed, pillows, towels, and Jean Nattier bath oil at the foot of the bed. Once in the bathroom, she pulled down her pants and sat, groaning with relief. "Here's where Lance had just been," she thought, and she giggled. And then she saw the bathroom was a mess. She was embarrassed for Lance. The grout between the pink tiles and the floor was grungy gray. A bra and panties lay mashed on top of the hamper, and car magazines were sloppily shoved into a built-in wall rack across from the toilet. If her mother could see this! Ruth stood, and that's when she noticed the dampness on her bottom. The toilet seat had been wet. Her mother had always warned her not to sit on other people's toilets, even those that are friends' homes. Men were supposed to lift the seat, but they never did.
"Every man forget," her mother had said. "They don't care. Leave germ there, put on you."
Ruth thought about rubbing off the pee with toilet paper, but then she decided it was a sign, like a pledge of love. It was Lance's pee, his germs, and leaving it on made her feel brave and romantic. A few days later, Ruth saw a movie in gym class that showed how eggs floated in a female body, traveling along primordial paths before falling out in a stream of blood. The movie was old and had been spliced in many places. A lady who looked like a nurse talked about the beginning of spring, and in the middle of describing the emergence of beautiful buds, she disappeared with a clack, then reappeared in another room describing buds moving inside a branch. While she was explaining about the womb as a nest, her voice turned into a flapping bird sound, and she disappeared into the cloud-white screen. When the lights came on, all the girls squinted in embarrassment, for now they were thinking about eggs moving inside them. The teacher had to call in a slouching, slack-mouthed boy from the audiovisual department. This made Wendy and several other girls squeal that they wanted to curl up and die. After the boys spliced the reel back together, the movie took up again, to show a tadpole called a sperm traveling through a heart-shaped womb, while a bus driver voice called out the destinations, "Vagina, cervix, uterus." The girls shrieked and covered their eyes until the boy swaggered out of the room, acting proud, as if he had seen them all naked. The movie continued, and Ruth watched the tadpole find the egg, which gobbled it up. A big-eyed frog began to grow. At the end of the movie, a nurse with a starch-white cap handed a googly baby to a beautiful woman in a pink satin jacket, as her manly husband declared, "It's a miracle, the miracle of life." When the lights came on, Wendy raised her hand and asked the teacher how the miracle got started in the first place, and the girls who knew the answer snorted and giggled. Ruth laughed as well. The teacher gave him a scolding look and said, "You have to get married first." Ruth knew that wasn't entirely true. She had seen a Rock Hudson and Doris Day movie. All it took was the right chemistry, which included love, and sometimes the wrong chemistry, which included booze and falling asleep. Ruth was not quite sure how everything occurred, but she was pretty certain those were the main things that activated a scientific change. It was similar to how Alka-Seltzer turned plain water into bubbly. Plop, plop, fizz, fizz. That wrong chemistry was why some women had babies born out of wedlock. Babies that were illegitimate. One of the B words. Before the class ended, the teacher passed out white elastic belts with clips and boxes containing thick white pads. She explained that the girls were due to have their first periods soon, and they should not be surprised or frightened if they saw a red stain on their panties. The stain was a sign that they had become women, and it was also an assurance that they were good girls. A lot of the girls tittered. Ruth thought the teacher was saying her period was due in the same way as homework, meaning it was due tomorrow, the day after, or next week. While she and Ruth walked home from school,
Wendy explained what the teacher had left out. Wendy knew things, because she hung out with her brother's pals and their girlfriends, the hard girls who wore makeup and stockings with nail polish dabbed over the runs. Wendy had a big blonde bubble hairdo that she teased and sprayed during recess, while chewing gum she saved between classes in a wad of tin foil. She was the first girl to wear white go-go boots, and before and after school, she rolled up her skirt so that it was 2 inches above her knees. She had been in detention 3 times, once for coming to school late, and twice for saying the other B-words, bitch and boner, to the gym teacher. On the way home, she bragged to Ruth that she had let a boy kiss her during a basement makeout party. He had just eaten a Neapolitan ice cream sandwich, and his breath tasted like barf, so I told him to kiss my neck, but not to go below. Below the neck, and you're a goner. She peeled open her collar, and Ruth gasped, seeing what looked like a huge bruise. What's that? A hickey, you dummy. Of course, they didn't show that in that crummy movie. Hickeys, hard-ons, home runs, it. Speaking of it, there was an older girl at this party puking her guts out in the bathroom. A 10th grader. She thought she was preggers from this boy who's in juvenile hall. Does she love him? She called him a creep. Then she doesn't have to worry, Ruth said knowingly. What are you talking about? It's the chemistry that gets you pregnant. Love is one of the ingredients, Ruth declared as scientifically as possible. Wendy stopped walking. Her mouth hung open. Then she whispered, Don't you know anything? And she explained what Ruth's mother, the lady in the movie, and the teacher had not talked about, that the ingredient came from a boy's penis. And to ensure everything was now perfectly clear to Ruth, Wendy spelled it out. The boy pees inside the girl. That's not true. Ruth hated Wendy for telling her this, for laughing hysterically. She was relieved when they reached the block where she and Wendy went in opposite directions. The last 2 blocks home, the truth of Wendy's words bounced in Ruth's head like pinballs. It made terrible sense, the part about the pee. That was why boys and girls had separate bathrooms. That's why boys were supposed to lift the seat, but they didn't, just to be bad. And that was why her mother always told her never to sit on the toilet seat in someone else's bathroom. What her mother had said about germs was really a warning about sperms. Why couldn't her mother learn to speak English right? And then panic grabbed her, for now she remembered that 3 nights before, she had sat on pee from the man she loved. Ruth checked her underwear 12 times a day. By the 4th day after the movie, her period had not come. Now look what's happened, she cried to herself. She walked around the bungalow, staring blankly. She had ruined herself, and there was no changing this. Love, pee, booze, she counted the ingredients on her fingers over and over. She remembered how brave she had felt, falling asleep without wiping off the pee. Why you act so crazy? Her mother often asked. Of course, she could not tell her mother she was pregnant. Experience had taught her that her mother worried too much even when she had no reason to worry. If there was something really wrong, her mother would scream and pound her chest like a gorilla. She would do this in front of Lance and Dottie. She would dig out her eyes and yell for the ghost to come take her away. And then she would really kill herself, this time for sure. She would make Ruth watch to punish her even more. Now, whenever Ruth saw Lance, she breathed so hard and fast her lungs seized up and she nearly fainted from lack of air. She had a constant stomach ache. Sometimes her stomach went into spasm and she stood over the toilet, heaving, but nothing came out. When she ate, she imagined the food falling into the baby frog's mouth, and then her stomach felt like a gunky swamp, and she had to run to the bathroom and make herself retch, hoping the frog would leap into the toilet and her troubles could be flushed away. I want to die, she moaned to herself. Die, die, die. First she cried a lot in the bathroom, then sliced her wrist with a dinner knife. It left a row of plowed-up skin, no blood, and it hurt too much to cut any deeper. Later in the backyard she found a rusty tack in the dirt, poked her fingertip, and waited for blood poisoning to rise up her arm, like liquid in a thermometer. That evening, still alive and miserable, she filled the tub and sat in it. As she sank under and was about to open her mouth wide, she remembered the water was now dirty with nasty stuff from her feet, her bottom, and the place between her legs. Still determined, she got out of the tub, dried off, and filled the sink, then lowered her face until it touched the water. She opened her mouth. How easy it was, drowning. It didn't hurt at all. It was like drinking water, which after a while she realized was what she was doing. So she pushed her face lower into the water and opened her mouth again. She took a deep breath, welcoming death at last. Her whole body backfired in stinging protest. She began coughing in such a loud and hacking way that her mother rushed in without knocking and pounded her back, put her hand on her forehead, and murmured in Chinese that she was sick and should go to bed right away. Having her mother comfort her so lovingly only made Ruth feel worse. The first person Ruth finally confessed her secret to was Wendy. She knew things. She always knew what to do. Ruth had to wait until she saw her at school, because there was no way she could talk about this on the party line phone without having her mother or someone else overhear. "You have to tell Lance," Wendy said, then reached over and squeezed Ruth's hand. That made Ruth cry even harder. She shook her head. The cruel world and its impossibilities swam in front of her. Lance didn't love her. If she told him, he would hate her. Dottie would hate her. They would kick her mother and her out of the bungalow. The school would send Ruth to juvenile hall, and her life would be over. "Well, if you don't tell Lance, I will," Wendy said. "Don't," Ruth managed to choke out. "You can't. I won't let you." "If you don't tell him, how else will he realize that he loves you?"
"He doesn't love me."
"Sure he does, or he will. Lots of times it happens that way. The guy finds out a baby is coming, and then, boom, love marriage, baby carriage."
Ruth tried to imagine it.
"Yep, it's yours," Wendy would say to Lance.
She pictured Lance looking like Rock Hudson when he learned Doris Day was going to have his baby. He would look stunned. But slowly he would begin to smile, then grin like a fool and race into the street, unmindful of traffic or people he bumped into, people who shouted back that he was nuts, and he would yell, "I am nuts, nuts about her." Soon he was by her side, on his knees, telling her he loved her, had always loved her, and now wanted to marry her. As for Dottie, well, she would soon fall in love with the postman or someone. Everything would work out. Ruth sighed. It was possible. That afternoon, Wendy went home with Ruth. Luling worked the afternoon shift at a nursery school and would not be home for another 2 hours. At 4, while they were outside, they saw Lance stride to his car, whistling and jingling his keys. Wendy broke away from Ruth, and Ruth ran to the other side of the bungalow where she could both hide and watch. She could hardly breathe. Wendy was walking toward Lance. "Hello," she called to him.
"Hey there, girlie," he said. "What's up?"
And then Wendy turned around and fled. Ruth started to cry, and when Wendy came back, she consoled Ruth, telling her she had a better plan.
"Don't worry," she said. "I'll take care of it. I'll think of something."
And she did.
"Wait here," she said, smiling, and ran up the back porch of the cottage.
Ruth dashed into the bungalow. 5 minutes later, the back door to the cottage flew open and Dottie raced down the porch steps. Through the window, Ruth saw Wendy wave to her before walking away quickly, then came pounding on the door to the bungalow. And when Ruth answered, Dottie was there, grabbing her by both hands. She stared into her eyes with a stricken face and whispered hoarsely in her milk and metal voice,
"Are you really?"
Ruth started bawling, and Dottie put her arm around her shoulders, soothing her, then squeezing her so hard Ruth thought her bones would pop out of their sockets. It hurt, but also felt good.
"That bastard, that dirty, filthy bastard," Dottie kept saying through gritted teeth.
Ruth was shocked to hear the B word, but even more so to realize that Dottie was angry, not with her, but with Lance.
"Does your mommy know?" Dottie asked.
Ruth shook her head.
"All right. For now, we don't need to tell her, not yet. First, let me think how we're going to take care of this, okay? It won't be easy, but I'll figure out what to do. Don't worry. 5 years ago, the same thing happened to me."
So that was why Lance had married her. But where was the baby? I know how you feel, Dottie went on. I really do. And Ruth cried even harder, bursting with more feelings than she ever thought a heart could hold. Someone was angry for her. Someone knew what to do. That night, as her mother cooked with the windows cracked open, loud voices punctured the air above the sound of spitting oil. Ruth pretended to read Jane Eyre. Her ears were straining to hear the words from outside, but the only thing she could make out was Dottie's high-pitched shriek. "You filthy bastard!" Lance's voice was a low rumble, like the revving of his Pontiac. Ruth went into the kitchen and reached under the sink. "I'm going to take out the garbage." Her mother gave her a raised eyebrow, but kept cooking. As Ruth approached the cans by the side of the cottage, she slowed down to listen. "You think you're so hot? How many others have you screwed? You're nothing but a 30-second wonder. Yeah, wham, bam, thank you, ma'am. What makes you the goddamn expert, I'd like to know?" "I do know. I know what a real man is. Danny." "Yeah, him. And he was good. Danny is a real man. But you gotta stick it up little girls who don't know any better." Lance's voice rose and broke like a crying boy's. "You goddamn fucking whore." When Ruth went back into the house, she was still shaking. She had not expected everything to be so crazy and ugly. Being careless could cause terrible trouble. You could be bad without even meaning to be. "Those people who li who do," her mother muttered. She set the steaming food on the table. "Crazy, argue over nothing." And then she closed the windows. Hours later, as Ruth lay wide awake in bed, the muffled shouts and screams suddenly stopped. She listened for them to begin again, but all she detected were her mother's snores. She rose in the pitch dark and went into the bathroom. She climbed on the toilet seat and looked out the window across the yard. The cottage lights were burning. What was going on? And then she saw Lance walk out with a duffel bag and hurl it into the trunk of his car. A moment later, he spun the tires on the gravel and took off with a roar. What did that mean? Had he told Dottie he was going to marry Ruth? The next morning, Saturday, Ruth barely touched the rice porridge her mother had heated up. She waited anxiously for the Pontiac to return, but everything remained quiet. She slumped onto the sofa with her book. Her mother was putting dirty clothes, towels, and sheets into a bag draped over a cart. She counted out the quarters and dimes needed for the laundromat, then said to Ruth, "Let's go, wash close time." "I don't feel so good. Sick? I think I'm going to throw up." Her mother fussed over her, taking her temperature, asking her what she had eaten, what her stools looked like. She made Ruth lie down on the sofa and placed a bucket nearby in case she really did get sick. At last her mother departed for the laundromat. She would be gone for at least 3 hours. She always pushed the cart to a place 20 minutes away, because the washers there were a nickel cheaper than those at the closer places, and the dryers didn't burn the clothes. Ruth put on a jacket and strayed outside. She slid into the chair on the porch, opened her book, and waited. 10 minutes later, Dottie opened the back door of the cottage, climbed down the 4 steps, and strode across the yard. Her eyes were puffy like a toad's, and when she smiled at Ruth, the upper half of her face looked tragic. "How you doing, kiddo?" "Okay, I guess." Dottie sighed, sat down on the porch, and dropped her chin onto her knees. "He's gone," she said. "But he's going to pay, don't you worry." "I don't want any money," Ruth protested. Dottie laughed once, then sniffed. "I mean he's going to jail." Ruth was frightened. "Why?" "Because of what he did to you, of course." "But he didn't mean to. He just forgot." "Forgot you were only 11? Geez." "It was my fault, too. I should have been more careful." "Honey, no, no, no. You don't have to protect him. Really, it's not your fault or the baby's. Now listen, you're going to have to talk to the police." "No, no, I don't want to." "I know you're scared, but what he did was wrong. It's called statutory rape, and he has to be punished for it. Anyway, the police will probably ask you a lot of questions, and you just tell them the truth, what he did,
Where it happened? Was it in the bedroom?
The bathroom.
Jeez. Dottie nodded bitterly. Yeah, he always did like it in there. So he took you to the bathroom?
I went by myself.
All right, and then he followed you, and then what? Did he have his clothes on?
Ruth was aghast.
He stayed in the living room watching TV,
she said in a tiny voice. I was in the bathroom by myself.
Then when did he do it?
Before me. He peed first, then I did.
Wait a second. He what?
He peed.
On you?
On the toilet seat. Then I went in and sat on it.
Dottie stood up, her face twisted with horror.
Oh, no. Oh, my God.
She grabbed Ruth by the shoulders and shook her.
That's not how babies are made. Pee on the toilet seat. How could you be so stupid? He has to stick his cock in you. He squirts sperm, not piss. Do you realize what you've done? You accused an innocent man of raping you.
I didn't, Ruth whispered.
Yes, you did, and I believed you.
Dottie stomped off, cursing.
I'm sorry, Ruth cried after her. I said I'm sorry.
She was still not certain what she had done. Dottie turned around and sneered.
You have no idea what sorry really is.
And then she went inside and banged the door shut.
Though she was no longer pregnant, Ruth felt no relief. Everything was still awful, maybe even worse.
When her mother returned from the laundromat, Ruth was lying under the covers in bed, pretending to be asleep. She felt stupid and scared. Would she go to jail? And though she knew now that she was not pregnant, she wanted to die more than ever. But how? She pictured herself lying under the wheels of the Pontiac, Lance starting the car and taking off, crushing her without even knowing it. If she died like her father, he would meet her in heaven. Or would he, too, think she was bad?
Ah, good girl, her mother murmured. You sleep, feel better soon.
Later that afternoon, Ruth heard the sounds of the Pontiac pulling into the driveway. She peeked out the window. Lance, grim-faced, carried out some boxes, two suitcases, and a cat from the cottage. Then Dottie came out, dabbing her nose with a tissue. She and Lance never looked at each other, and then they were gone. An hour later, the Pontiac returned, but only Lance got out. What had Dottie told Lance? Why did Dottie have to move out? Would Lance now march up to their door and tell her mother what Ruth had done and demand that they move out that same day as well? Lance hated her. Ruth was sure of that. She had thought being pregnant was the worst thing that could have happened to her, but this was far worse. She stayed home from school on Monday. Luling became increasingly fearful that a ghost was trying to take her daughter away. Why else was Ruth still sick? Luling rambled about bony teeth from a monkey's jaw. Precious Auntie would know, she kept saying. She knew about the curse. This was punishment for something the family had done a long time ago. She put the sand tray on a chair by Ruth's twin bed, waiting.
Both us die? She asked. Or only me?
No, Ruth wrote. All okay.
What okay, okay? Then why is she sick? No reason.
On Tuesday, Ruth could not stand her mother's fussing over her any longer. She said she was well enough to go to school. Before opening the door, she looked out the window, then down the driveway. Oh, no, the Pontiac was still there. She was trembling so hard she feared her bones might break. After taking a deep breath, she darted out the door, scooted down the side of the driveway farther from the cottage, then edged past the Pontiac. She turned left, even though school was to the right.
Hey, Squirt, I've been waiting for you.
Lance was on the porch, smoking a cigarette.
We need to talk.
Ruth stood rooted to the sidewalk, unable to move.
I said we need to talk. Don't you think you owe me that?
Come here. He threw the burning cigarette onto the lawn. Ruth's legs moved shakily forward. The top half of her was still running away. When she reached the top of the porch, she was numb. She looked up.
I'm sorry,
she squeaked. The quiver in her chin shook open her mouth, and sobs burbled out.
Hey, hey, Lance said. He looked nervously down the street. Come on, you don't have to do that. I wanted to talk so we could have an understanding.
Just don't want this to ever happen again, okay?
Ruth sniffed and nodded.
All right, then. So settle down. Don't get all spooky on me.
Ruth wiped at her teary face with her sweater sleeve. The worst was over. She started to go down the stairs.
Hey, where are you going?
Ruth froze.
We still have to talk. Turn around.
His voice was not quite so gentle. Ruth saw he had opened the door. She stopped breathing.
Inside, he ordered.
She bit her lip and slowly climbed back up, then glided past him. She heard the door close and saw the room go dim. The living room smelled like booze and cigarettes. The curtains were closed, and there were empty TV dinner trays on the coffee table.
Sit down. Lance gestured toward the scratchy sofa. Want a soda?
She shook her head. The only light came from the TV, which was tuned to an old movie. Ruth was glad for the noise. And then she saw a commercial, a man selling cars. In his hand was a fake saber.
We've slashed our prices, so come on down to Rudy's Chevrolet and ask to see the slasher.
Lance sat on the sofa, not as close as he had been that night. He took her books from her arms, and she felt unprotected. Tears blurred her eyes, and she tried hard not to make any sounds as she cried.
She left me, you know.
A sob burst out of Ruth's chest. She tried to say she was sorry, but she could make only mouse-like sniffles. Lance laughed.
Actually, I kicked her out. Yeah, in a way, you did me a favor. If it weren't for you, I wouldn't have found out she was screwing around. Oh, sure, I kind of suspected it for a while, but I told myself, man, you gotta have trust. And you know what? She didn't trust me. Can you believe it? Me! Let me tell you something. You can't have a marriage if you don't have trust. You know what I mean?
He looked at her. Ruth desperately nodded.
Nah, you won't know for another 10 years.
He lit another cigarette.
You know, in 10 years you'll look back and say, boy, I sure was dumb about how babies are made.
He snorted, then cocked his head to get her reaction.
Aren't you going to laugh? I think it's kind of funny myself, don't you?
He started to pat her arm, and she flinched without intending to.
Hey, what's the matter? Uh-oh, don't tell me you don't trust me. What are you, like her? After what you did and what I certainly did not do, do you think I now deserve this kind of treatment from you?
Ruth was quiet for a long time, trying to make her lips move right. Finally, she said in a cracked voice, I trust you.
Yeah?
He patted her arm again, and this time she didn't jerk stupidly. He continued talking in a weary but reassuring voice.
Listen, I'm not going to yell at you or nothing, okay? So just relax. Okay? Hey, I said okay.
Okay.
Give me my smile.
She forced her lips to pull upward.
There it is. Oops, gone again.
He stubbed out his cigarette.
All right, are we friends again?
He stuck out his hand for her to shake.
Good. It'd be terrible if we couldn't be friends since we live next door to each other.
She smiled at him, and this time it came naturally. She tried to breathe through her clogged nose.
And being neighbors, we gotta help each other, not go around accusing someone innocent of doing wrong.
Ruth nodded and realized she was still gripping her toes. She relaxed. Soon this would be over. She saw that he had dark circles under his eyes, lines running from his nose to his jaw. Funny, he looked much older than she remembered, no longer as handsome. And then she realized it was because she was no longer in love with him. How strange! She had believed it was love, and it never was. Love was forever.
So now you know the real way babies are made, don't you?
Ruth stopped breathing. She ducked her head.
Well, do you or don't you?
She nodded quickly.
How? Tell me.
She squirmed, her mind turning around and around. She saw terrible pictures. A brown hot dog squirting yellow mustard. She knew the words, penis, sperm, vagina, but how could she say them? Then the nasty picture would be in front of both of them. You know, she whimpered. He looked at her sternly. It was as if he had X-ray eyes.
Yeah, he finally said. I know.
He was silent for a few seconds, then added in a friendlier voice.
Boy, were you dumb. Babies and toilet seats, jeez.
Ruth kept her head down, but her eyes glanced up at him. He was smiling.
I hope you one day do a better job teaching your kids about the facts of life. Toilet seat. Pee? P-U.
Ruth giggled.
Ah, I knew you could laugh.
He poked his finger under her armpit and tickled her. She squealed politely. He tickled her again, lower along her ribs, and she spasmed as a reflex. Then suddenly his other hand reached for her other armpit, and she groaned with laughter, helpless, too scared to tell him to stop. He twirled his fingers around her back, along her stomach. She balled herself up like a sow bug and fell to the rug below with terrible gasping giggles.
You think a lot of things are funny, don't you?
He twiddled his fingers up and down her ribs as if they were harp strings.
Yeah, I can see that now. Did you tell all your little girlfriends, ha-ha, I must put that guy in jail?
She tried to cry, no, stop, don't, but she was laughing too hard, unable to take a breath on her own, unable to control her arms or legs. Her skirt was tangled, but she couldn't pull it down. Her hands were like that of a marionette, twitching toward wherever he touched, as she tried to keep his fingers away from her stomach, her breasts, her bottom. Tears poured out. He was pinching her nipples.
You're just a little girl, he panted. You don't even have any titties yet. Why would I want to mess around with you? Shit, I bet you don't even have any tushy hairs.
And when both of his hands shot down to pull off her flowered panties, her voice broke free and blasted out as screeches. Over and over, she made a fierce, sharp sound that came from an unknown place. It was as though another person had burst out of her.
Whoa, whoa, he said, holding up his hands like someone being robbed. What are you doing? Get a hold of yourself. Would you just calm down, for Christ's sake?
She continued the siren-like wail, scuttling on her bottom away from him, pulling up her panties, pushing down her dress.
I'm not hurting you. I am not hurting you.
He repeated this until she settled into whimpers and wheezes, and then there came just fast breathing in the space between them. He shook his head in disbelief.
Am I imagining things, or weren't you just laughing a moment ago? One second we're having fun, the next second you're acting like, well, I don't know, you tell me.
He squinted hard at her.
You know, maybe you have a big problem. You start to get this funny idea in your head that people are doing something wrong to you, and before you can see what's true, you accuse them and go crazy and wreck everything. Is that what you're doing?
Ruth got up. Her legs were shaky. I'm going to go, she whispered. She could hardly walk to the door.
You're not going anywhere until you promise you're not going to spread any more of your goddamn lies. You got that straight?
He walked toward her.
You better not say I did something to you when I didn't, because if you do, I'm going to get really mad and do something that'll make you sorrier than hell, you hear?
She nodded dumbly. He blew air out of his nose, disgusted.
Get out of here, scram.
That night, Ruth tried to tell her mother what had happened.
Ma, I'm scared.
Why scare?
Luling was ironing. The room had the smell of fried water.
That man, Lance, he was mean to me.
Her mother scowled, then said in Chinese,
This is because you're always bothering him. You think he wants to play with you. He doesn't. Why do you always make trouble?
Ruth felt sick to her stomach. Her mother saw danger where there wasn't, and now that something was truly, really awful, she was blind. If Ruth told her the actual truth, she would probably go crazy. She'd say she didn't want to live anymore. So what difference did it make? She was alone. No one could save her. An hour later, while Luling was knitting and watching television, Ruth took down the sand tray by herself.
Precious Auntie wants to tell you something, she told her mother.
Ah?
Luling said. She immediately stood up and turned off the TV and eagerly sat down at the kitchen table. Ruth smoothed the sand with a chopstick. She closed her eyes, then opened them and began.
You must move, Ruth wrote. Now.
Move? Her mother cried.
Aya, where we should move?
Ruth had not considered this.
Far away, she finally decided.
Where far?
Ruth imagined a distance as big as an ocean. She pictured the bay, the bridge, the long bus ride she had taken with her mother that made her fall asleep. San Francisco, she wrote at last. Her mother still looked worried.
What part? Where good?
Ruth hesitated. She did not know San Francisco that well except for Chinatown and a few other places.